Kaiser, good morning.
Good morning, Your Honor. Your Honor, I'd like to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal. May it please the Court. This case presents three issues. First, a competency question. Second, a Speedy Trial Act issue. And third, an issue about the application of Sentencing Guideline 3C1.1. I'd like to start with the competency issue. 18 U.S.C. 4241 makes clear that if there's reasonable cause to think that a defendant might not be competent, might be incompetent, the district court shall, on its own motion, order a competency hearing. And if a competency hearing is ordered, then the defendant is afforded the protections of a separate statutory section. Competency has two elements. One, that the defendant is, as relevant here, able to properly assist his counsel in his defense, and second, that he's suffering from a mental disease or defect, which is causing the inability to suffer, the inability to help his lawyer present a defense. Here, from this record, it's clear Mr. Hines wasn't able to properly help his lawyer. He went through court-appointed lawyers. He started with the Federal Public Defender's Office. The Federal Public Defender's Office was fired relatively early in the case. He had a second court-appointed lawyer. He was unable to work with that court-appointed lawyer. There's a lengthy hearing on August 26th where that attorney and the court discuss Mr. Hines' inability to focus on the facts that matter in the case, his inability to talk about things that are going to move the ball with respect to trial. And the district court made an impressive record about how Mr. Hines was talking about irrelevant issues and trivia.
What else did he have? He didn't have a defense.
That may be. Although when a person doesn't have a defense, there are other options. He could have talked about a plea. He could have talked about almost anything else. But what the record shows is that Mr. Hines continually kept focusing on things that just didn't matter. He wanted to see the transcript of the grand jury proceeding where the grand jurors voted. He was worried that he wasn't arrested. He was arrested on probable cause. He wanted to see the criminal complaint that authorized his arrest. Even in the middle of trial, on the second day of trial testimony, his lawyer came and made a record before the district court and said, look, my guy's not talking to me. He's just not talking to me about what I should be doing in this trial. He's still focused on this bizarre issue that the district court has already told him is not going to go anywhere about where the warrant was that authorized his arrest.
Isn't it significant that none of his lawyers agreed with you? I mean, they were asked repeatedly, and none of them thought there was a competency issue.
Respectfully, Your Honor, I would disagree that it's significant. What this court said in Jones is that, of course, it's a factor. Of course, what counsel says matters, but it's not a decisive factor. And moreover, I think the district court in the sentencing hearing where it found Mr. Hines competent without a competency hearing, I think it misconstrued what prior counsel had said. The record's relatively clear that his first attorney, Ms. Peterson, simply didn't weigh in on competence. She had a mental health evaluation. She told the court that the mental health evaluation was for the purposes of trying to get a reduction at sentencing and didn't say anything about competency. Moreover,
the only discussion was about some bipolar disorder, and that wouldn't make him incompetent, would it?
Well, respectfully, Your Honor, I don't know. I mean, what Congress has said, and I think this is really good judgment on Congress's part, is that lawyers and judges aren't mental health professionals. If there's reasonable cause to think that a person has a mental defect that's keeping them from helping their lawyer to put together a defense, then there's kind of a hair trigger on it. As soon as there's reasonable cause, boom, a district court shall order a competency evaluation.
Well, how does that square, though, with the district judge's own finding that he lied, which shows some, that doesn't mean that incompetence can't lie, but that showed some deviousness and some thought when she gave him the obstruction of justice enhancement?
Sure. I think for the competency question, I think that doesn't, evidence of deviousness doesn't dispel a concern about competency. An incompetent person can still be devious. I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Isn't there a difference between inability to assist your counsel and unwillingness? In other words, if he's just recalcitrant, That doesn't mean he's not competent.
Absolutely, Your Honor. That's absolutely the case. And if all there was on this record was an unwillingness or an inability to assist counsel, this case would be a lot closer to Jones. It's interesting, I think, just to distinguish this case from Jones a little bit on a minor point, that in Jones, the district court made express findings that the person wasn't unable to assist counsel, was simply unwilling to assist counsel. And that's not the record that the district court made here. But more fundamentally, unlike Jones, this is a case where we have reason to think that he suffers from a mental disease or defect. We've got both elements of the competency analysis. He was diagnosed with post-traumatic stress disorder. He's got a prior diagnosis of bipolar disorder. He was found not guilty by reason of insanity in a prior case in Virginia. The record is frustrating in that respect that we don't have the court documents from Virginia, but all of that, it gives rise.
Where did the PTSD stem from?
Sure. When Mr. Hines was youth, what the mental health expert found is that he witnessed his father murder his brother in front of him when he was a child. And that was a result, I don't know how far the court wants to go with this, but Mr. Hines was calling 900 numbers. His father blamed his brother. His father...
How long ago was that?
I believe it was when Mr. Hines was 11 or 12, although I don't want to misconstrue. It's in the mental health report, which is part of the record. And Mr. Hines now, I believe, is in his mid-40s, so 30 years ago. It does sound like a dramatically traumatic event, and his family confirmed to the mental health professional he didn't talk for a year afterwards.
Why don't you get to your Speedy Trial Act?
Sure. If I could make one more point on competency, which is aside... What the district court did here, I think, is troubling for competency for one other reason, which is at the sentencing hearing, when no one was asking the district court to rule on competency, the district court said, I think this is an issue I need to talk about, and spent a number of pages in the transcript saying, going through the process of evaluating the competency question and making a finding that he is competent. What the district court said, in essence, is, look, this stuff here gives me pause. When things give you pause about competency and you're a district court judge, the statute requires you to have a competency hearing. The court cannot simply apply its own judgment and make a finding of competence without that hearing. That's the last point I want to make on competency. Thank you. With respect to the Speedy Trial Act issue, the argument here is a little intricate, admittedly. Mr. Hines was arrested in early March, on March 9th. He was indicted on June 3rd. That's more than 30 days. Of course, a person has to be under the Speedy Trial Act. They have to be indicted within 30 days of their arrest. There were two extensions, joint extensions, admittedly, filed to toll the Speedy Trial Act and to meet the ends of justice. Later, when the district court was concerned about the 90-day speedy trial clock, Mr. Hines' second attorney filed a motion to release him for a Speedy Trial Act violation. My argument here is, following on this court's opinion in Marshall, that attorney should have included an argument that the indictment should be dismissed for a violation of the 30-day trial clock, or 30-day speedy trial clock, and didn't. And his failure to do that was ineffective assistance of counsel. The court then resolved the 90-day clock issue and made findings. And those findings, as I've laid out in the brief, are simply not sufficient to meet this court and the Supreme Court standards for the kinds of detailed factual findings that have to be made to exclude time in the interest of justice. The district court found that for the purposes of permitting ongoing plea negotiations, such an exclusion outweighs the interest of the public and the defendant in a speedy trial. What this court has said in Bryant is that if a district court is going to have an exclusion for the ends of justice, the district court has to weigh in a meaningful way the countervailing considerations of not having an exclusion in the interest of justice. That's consistent with the Supreme Court's language in Zedner. What this court has said, what the Supreme Court has said, is that a district court judge has to show their work, in essence. And that's exactly not what the district court did in this case. For that reason, had Mr. Hines' second lawyer made a motion to dismiss the indictment for a violation of the 30-day trial clock, speedy trial clock, that motion would have been denied using similar language, and on appeal should be reversed by this court for not being compliant with Bryant and not being compliant with Sevier. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. Ms. Kurt.
Good morning. May it please the court, Suzanne Kurt on behalf of the United States of America. I'd like to address the speedy trial issue first. As we have stated in our brief, Your Honors, we do believe that this issue has been waived by the very language of the Speedy Trial Act. 3162A2 makes it very clear that failure to file a motion to dismiss in the district court prevents a defendant from raising any Speedy Trial Act issue
before trial.
On appeal.
Before trial.
Yes.
Yeah.
And there was no motion filed in this case, Your Honor. In his reply
is
brief.
Is that statute consistent with Barker versus Wingo?
Well, I believe so, Your Honor.
Has that ever been adjudicated?
That I do not know.
You know, because Barker is really the constitutional
right.
case.
Right.
And Justice Powell in that case said that whether the defendant moves to dismiss or ask for a speedy trial is just one of many factors to be taken into account in it. And that in itself does not amount to a waiver of the speedy trial right.
But here, of course, we're dealing with the statutory
I know.
And Zedner, I believe, is the controlling case on this. And we have a very specific statutory provision that requires an assertion of the right before it has, before it can be raised on appeal.
That's speedy trial. A speedy trial, as opposed to speedy indictment.
Right, but it applies there, as we have cited. There are cases that say it applies to both.
But not in this circuit.
Not in this circuit, no. But there, I have not found any cases that are contrary. Mm. Appellant argues that Zedner overtook that, but there are post-Zedner cases that have still maintained that the waiver must, the assertion, the right must be asserted before trial. And of course, in Zedner itself, the defendant did file a motion to dismiss. Zedner deals with the fact that a defendant himself cannot opt out of the operation of the Speedy Trial Act, but it doesn't address directly what has to be done in order to preserve that right for appeal, and we think the statute is very clear. And of course, appellant's not making a Barker versus Wingo type speedy trial claim in this case in any event. He's relying on the act, and we think that Zedner and post-Zedner cases are very clear on that issue, that it cannot be raised. In any event...
And the theory is that the defendant has to put up or shut up. I mean, oftentimes the delay is to the defendant's benefit, and if he just remains silent and goes to trial, then we used to call it trying a case with a net. Because you know that if you're convicted, it's going to be reversed.
That's right. Yeah. And the cases specifically say that that provision of 3162 was enacted to enable so that the defendants could not manipulate and remain silent. They have to assert the right one way or another. Mm-hmm. And that's the concept behind that portion of the statute. And in any event, even if it could be raised, it would only be plain error, and we don't think that appellant could not demonstrate plain error on these facts in any event, because the findings were made. This trial judge was very conscious of the speedy trial requirements. She raised it herself sua sponte. She talked about Zedner. She was keenly aware of the importance of what findings had to be made, and she took it upon herself to do that, and she did it in writing. So I don't think there's any possibility the claim could succeed in this particular case. With respect to the competence, I think that Judge Brown really zoned in on the issue when she stated that none of the attorneys raised an issue of competence, and in fact, two of them specifically stated that they believed he was competent, even up until the time of sentencing. His second two lawyers believed he was competent, and his first lawyer, the public defender, stated that the mental health examination was requested for a different purpose, and she certainly didn't raise any competency issue with the court.
Why did the magistrate raise the, what prompted the magistrate to raise the question?
The record is not clear on that, Your Honor. Judge Kolar-Catelli mentioned this at one point in August when she said that, it's interesting because it's after she has viewed the defendant's videotaped statement in which he apparently makes some reference to the fact that he had had treatment in the past.
Ah, okay.
So when she's talking about that, and she mentions that the magistrate had mentioned something about it as well, that's in the same paragraph. And that's when she goes on to address the competency issue. But it's not clear exactly what prompted that conversation between herself and Magistrate Judge Facciola. But in any event, I think it's significant that when Judge Kolar-Catelli does ultimately make her competency findings at the end of the case, she herself states that she has had numerous occasions to have conversations with the defendant, and although he may have had certain ideas about how his case should have been defended, that certainly didn't render him incompetent. I mean, he made what maybe all of us would agree are poor choices, but I think he was just, or the record seems to suggest he was hoping for some kind of technicality because the evidence against him was absolutely overwhelming and he had confessed.
Is your response to counsel's argument that once the judge says, well, there's something here that gives me pause, that everything stops and now you have to have a competency hearing?
I don't think that she said it gave her pause. She addresses that right after, in fact, Mr. Rudisill addressed the competency issue in his sentencing memorandum, and then he brought it up again at the sentencing right before Judge Kolar-Catelli addressed that particular issue. And since he put it on the record, I think she wanted to make the record straight as to and wanted to make sure that there were specific findings in the record. I think she was just saying to the extent that it may give anyone pause, it didn't give her pause for the following reasons. She also, as Judge Henderson pointed out, the whole issue about the lying and manipulation for the obstruction charge, when she was talking about the defendant's demeanor and his, on the tape, which she had seen the entire tape, which lasted about an hour, she specifically said he seemed calm and reasoned and very deliberate. And she didn't see any competency issues arising out of that either. So I think these factual findings were not clearly erroneous and should be upheld by this court. And unless there are further questions about any of the other issues, I would thank the court for its time this morning and ask it to affirm the judgment of the district court.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Does Mr. Kaiser have any time? Okay. Why don't you take a couple minutes?
Thanks, ma'am. With respect to I'll do the last issue first. With respect to the gives me pause language, I'd encourage the court to look at the joint appendix, page 1221, where the court says, in terms of the competency issue, I mean, the not guilty by reason of insanity certainly gives me pause. And then goes on to talk about at various points, and there have been concerns in terms of his ability to assist counsel, and then makes the finding that there's no competency here. I think the Tenth Circuit case cited in our brief is instructive. Once the door is open, once the judge says there's a reason to look at competency, that triggers a requirement of a competency hearing, and that's exactly what the district court didn't do here and what the district court should have done, and that's why we think there should be remand on that issue. Turning to the Speedy Trial Act question, I think there are two separate waiver issues with respect to the Speedy Trial Act, and I just want to hopefully shed light on that. One is the Speedy Trial Act waiver Judge Randolph was talking about, where a defendant has to file a motion before trial in order for it to be effective. The second is a sort of Zedner Speedy Trial Act issue, where the argument could be that because Mr. Hines joined with the government in requesting the Speedy Trial Act extension, that waives his ability to come in later and ask for it. With respect to the second waiver issue, Zedner, I think, precludes that. Zedner says there are factors beyond just the defendant's consent. Waiver was considered there. In Zedner, Mr. Zedner himself asked for continuance, tried to waive a speedy trial. The court said he can't do that. With respect to the question Judge Randolph was asking about with the statutory waiver, not filing the motion before trial, That, I think, moves into the ineffective assistance of counsel claim. It goes to this court's opinion in Marshall, where this court held that failure to file a motion to dismiss where there was a Speedy Trial Act violation was ineffective assistance of counsel and remanded with instructions to vacate for the Speedy Trial Act violation. So I think it's a separate issue. The response to that is Marshall, not Zedner. Zedner responds to the other waiver issue.
What were the facts in Marshall, though?
Sure. In Marshall, the government filed an evidentiary notice. I believe it was a notice of intent to use 404B evidence. And the district court found that that was sufficient to sort of toll speedy trial. Then the case went on for well past 70 days without a trial. Before trial, the defendant didn't file a Speedy Trial Act motion with respect to the 404B notice. This court had previously held in, I believe it was Bryant, that a 609 notice, a notice of intent to use 609, Rule 609 evidence, was not sufficient to toll speedy trial. There were no other motions filed in Marshall. And on appeal, this court, after argument, issued an order vacating and remanding because counsel's error in failing to file that Speedy Trial Act motion was sort of clear and ineffective assistance of counsel, then later issued the opinion sort of setting out the basis for that.
Okay. All right, Mr. Kaiser, we appointed you to represent the defendant, and you have done it very ably, and we thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.